BC Bookstore for their sponsorship of our series. And for those of you who are not members of the Institute, we'd like to recommend that you become members. It's $25 for a family membership, $15 for a single, and $5 for students. I should tell you before we go too much further that there is no program next week, and then on the 28th of February, Professor Michael Church of the Department of Geography at UBC will be speaking on the subject of a river in time and the natural history of the Fraser River. Sir? That's right. No, next week there's no lecture. The week after that there is a lecture. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Richard White, who is Professor of History at the University of Washington. He is a MacArthur Fellow and has held Guggenheim and Rockefeller Fellowships in recognition of his outstanding research. He is the author of The Organic Machine, The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, 1650 to 1815, It's Your Misfortune and None of My Own, A New History of the American West, and other books. His latest book, Remembering Ahanagran, revolves around stories told him by his mother of her girlhood in Ireland, her emigration to the United States, and her life in Chicago. Professor White's subject is History as the Enemy of Memory, An Anatomy of Remembering. Please welcome Professor Richard White.
Thank you.
For the past several years, I've been doing something unusual for a historian. I've been writing a book about my mother. This is not a book about mothers or motherhood in general, nor is the book a disguised way of examining my own life, as the memoirs of others so often are. At least I hope not. I long ago came to the conclusion that the unexamined life is the only one worth living, and I've tried to abide by that ever since. This book is about my mother, born Sarah Welsh in 1919, in the village of Ballylongford, in the north of County Kerry, in the west of Ireland. Several years ago, my mother, who has long collected my books and actually displayed them, but has never, to the best of my knowledge, tried to read one. Actually tried to read one. She never finished it. "I'm more interesting than this," she told me. "Why don't you write a book about me?" Since I was a small child, I've been hearing my mother's stories about her girlhood in Ireland, her emigration to America, to Chicago when she was 16, her early life in Chicago, her marriage to my father. He was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants. She was Irish Catholic with a fourth grade education. He had gone to Harvard. I'd always been fascinated by these stories and thought I could easily put them into historical context. "You're on," I told her. But the book I wrote became neither a compilation of her stories nor a contextualization of them. I was not a mere amanuensis recording what I was told. And if I was an amanuensis at all, I think my mother began to regard me as an amanuensis from hell. Instead, the book became a history of my mother's stories, a history of her memories. And what I mean by a history of memories and how it has come to complicate both memory and history for me is the subject of this talk. Memory is very much in vogue these days, both among historians and in popular literature. But attention to memory operates on a series of somewhat contradictory levels. There's a tendency in popular culture to confuse memory with history. David Thielen, the editor of the Journal of American History, had a poll conducted in 1995 about popular attitudes towards the past. He wondered about the public's attitude towards history and historians. What he found was interesting. When he asked people about the most reliable source of the past, people chose grandmothers over historians. Grandmothers, they thought, unlike most historians, had been there. And in their memories, they preserved an account of what things were really like. This belief in memory as a direct and literal recorder of experience seems also to exist in popular nonfiction. We seem to live in the golden age of the memoir. Just citing American examples, Mary Gordon's The Shadow Man, Calvin Trillin's Messages from My Father, Mary Clearman Blue's Balsam Root, Henry Louis Gates' Colored People, Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes, and I could go on and on and on, are part of a flood of memoirs. If they think about it, many people may doubt if Frank McCourt really can remember verbatim conversations that he heard when he was 6 or 7 years old. But with some exceptions, the authors of these books and the readers largely accept the record of memory. They rarely question it. Historians do not grant memory the privileged status that the public or the authors of memoirs do. We don't have the same trust in grandmothers. But we do take memory quite seriously. Outside of collecting oral histories, however, our concern has largely been with myth, tradition, and public memory, the widely disseminated accounts of the past that appear in memorials, paid pageants, and celebrations. These, however, are memories shared by millions of people. Historians have given relatively little attention to how individuals construct accounts of their own past, the stuff of memoirs, which, while intersecting with larger constructions of the past, such as public memory, are really quite distinct from them. What I tried to do in collaboration with my mother was to examine individual stories she told me about the past, stories based on the authority of memory. History, I came to realize in writing this book, is the enemy of memory. Historians question the authority of memory, they subvert it, they match memories against each other and against other relics of the past. They give memory no rest. Since memory in the book I wrote did not receive unquestioned authority for calling up a past world, I've begun to think of the book as an anti-memoir. Yet at the same time, my aim in all of this is not to debunk memory. My mother's memories and stories are a making sense. They're a reworking of the past in light of the person that she has become and continues to become. I'm not interested in debunking them. It would be a mean-spirited, trivial, and ultimately despicable thing willfully to destroy the memories of one you love. That my mother's memories are not a literal rendition of the past, not a transparent window on her experiences, is the beginning of the book I wrote. Not its end. I'm interested in my mother's memories for what they are, not for what they are not. But to find out what they are, I had to engage them, question them, put them in conversation with what I do know something about, and that is history. Thus far, I've spoken of history and memory as if the distinction between them is obvious. Putting memory into conversation with history means that I have to specify the identity of the participants in this conversation. And this is an admittedly problematic task. Both memory and history are relational terms. They exist only as they put the past in relation with the present. Both are creative acts. We do not discover or find or recover either memory or history. We create them. Nor are they entirely separate. They can hybridize. Public memory is such a hybrid. Still, memory and history are distinguishable. Individual memory is, in my formulation, a living thing. It exists in the minds of living human beings. It exists in the minds of all of you. It cannot be separated from the minds of living human beings. When it is, it becomes something else. Like history, memory is devoted to using the past to make sense of the present. But memory constantly rearranges the past, often unconsciously, as the perspective of the person doing the remembering changes. I'm not talking about interpretation, what the past means, or what its significance is, or what's important about it. I'm talking of the past itself. The past is very malleable in memory. Written down, recorded, such memories become the stuff of history. What we remembered yesterday, as every lawyer knows, subverts what we remember today. History shares with memory the task of making sense of the present through use of the past. Like the remembered past, history changes over time. You only need to consult narrative histories written at different points in the 20th century to see how it changes. But look closer, and differences emerge. What the past means, what past matters, what's significant, what gets talked about in the past, all of these things are contested and shifting. But historians rarely quarrel about what happened in the past. We base our faith on dead things, documents, artifacts, things which are not supposed to change, even as the interpretations of them change. Our faith is in the footnote. Show us the thing itself. History, while very much an act of creation and interpretation in the present, is far less free than memory. It is anchored in the dead stuff that the past leaves among us. Most non-historians are amazed by how much debris a normal life leaves. My mother was astonished by what I could find out about her. I found her interviews with immigration agents in 1936. I could find her attendance records from the second grade. I could find her grandfather's indebtedness at the end of the 19th century to Trinity College of Dublin. I could find her father's application for citizenship. I could find transcripts of trials, hearings, letters my father wrote when applying for college, transcripts of stories her cousins told as school children in the 1930s. Non-historians think that historians struggle with the paucity of sources, and in some cases this may be true. But for North American historians, at least, the problem is not a paucity of sources. It is digging out from underneath the debris of the past. This material does not form a story in and of itself. Historians do that. But this debris, this stuff of history, can sink stories, as well as become part of them. Our stories and our memories float on narrative seas like the Titanic. The debris of the past forms icebergs that are ready to sink them. It is in this sense that history is the enemy of memory. It is in this sense that when I set out to examine my mother's stories, history and memory could only collide. Engaging in this project with my mother made me realize the cruelty of history. I never realized how cruel the work I do for a living can be. It made me realize why people prefer grandmothers to historians like me. It's a cruel work on two levels. First of all, because history hurts without malice. It often inflicts pain like a torturer, with no particular dislike of its victim. And second, history disrupts the primary function of memory, which is forgetting. I realize that these can be abstract and paradoxical points, so let me make them particular. First, history hurts without malice. In the Irish townland of Gahard, where my mother Sarah's mother was born, her uncle, Tom Haggerty, married Bridget Lynch, who was an epileptic. Bridget Lynch brought a fortune, as dowries were called in rural Ireland, to the farm Tom inherited from his father. Sarah, my mother, would often ride her bicycle to Gahard on messages. One of Sarah's stories is about the time she went to Gahard and saw her Aunt Bridget in the midst of an epileptic fit. But it is only the end of this story, or rather the story that it spins into, that concerns me here. Sarah's Uncle Tom and Aunt Bridget had a son who will go unnamed. They in turn aged, and he in turn married and inherited the farm. This was after Sarah had left Ireland. His parents continued to share the house, but the family disintegrated. The son drank and married and then lost a wife. I do not know how. He, so the story goes, shut off his own mother and father, Tom and Bridget, from the kitchen of the house by partitioning the house. He shut them up in a room which in the old Irish cottages they call behind the fire. He blocked off the connecting door so they could both enter that room only from the outside. They lost access to the kitchen. Tom died of a heart attack collecting sticks to start his fire. And then one day during an epileptic attack, Bridget fell into the fire in that closed off room. The sun had come only when he smelled her burning flesh. Gangrene set in. She died shortly afterwards in a Listowel hospital. In 1981, I came with my mother to this house that had once been her grandmother's and then her uncle's. The house was still standing, but the roof was gone. There was a small stream running through the building. It came in the back door and out the front. By then, the son of Tom and Bridget, too, had died in this house. As the story goes, he had died a drunken wreck, and in wrecking himself, he had wrecked the house and nearly wrecked what remained of the family. After his mother's death, he had continued to drink. The drinking had distracted him from farming, and the drinking had distracted him from cutting turf in the bogs. And when winter came, there was no turf to burn. To keep warm, he had begun burning furniture and then the house itself. He had burned most of the wood that the house contained, sparing only a table, a chair, and a bedstead. He had stripped the interior wood and burned it in the hearth. The cold and the drink and the sickness got to him before the winter ended. He died in bed. This is a story widely told around Ballylongford. It is a story that my mother and others have told me. Life in Ballylongford was and is lived as an annotated text. Things happened, they were described, and they were commented on. Ballylongford was a small village, and gossip ran like a stream through its streets. In a place so poor, there was often nothing to share but the talk. Much of the talk was wonderful, and its cadences brightened Sarah's life yet, but much of it was cruel and vicious and meant to wound. Talk was the solution in which horrible things were preserved and kept for inspection. Yet this story, painful as gossip, seems different and crueler in print. My mother recoils from it. And although she has told it numerous times, she wants it stricken from the record of her memories and stories. There's no malice in my placing the story on the page, but that makes it seem all the more cruel. I, the teller, have no connection with those who enacted it. Why must I tell it? I tell the story because it is true, because it was told to me, because it seems necessary to evoke the place from which my mother, Sarah, came. The story is one of the occasions that we clash, my mother and myself. Her memories and stories are hers, and she wants the right to edit them as she wishes, even after they have spilled out on the page. History, which denies such personal possession of the past, seems to her an unnatural act. Why is it necessary to tell these things? Have mercy, she tells me. And if I edit out what might be offensive to my family, I ask her, how can I have any standing to give offense to anyone's family? Do I take out everything that might give anyone offense? Indeed, I was asked to take out so many things in this book that at one time I told my mother this might be the first book in which the author wasn't anonymous, but all the characters in the book were anonymous. My mother's memory serves the present. Its loyalty is to the people she may see next week or next month and to whom she will have to explain herself. She is thousands of miles from Ballylongford, and she is among them yet. My history, too, is for the present, but its loyalty is, I think, at least partially to a past. I recognize that this past is in part of my own construction, but that seems all the more reason to you to the rules of my craft. By making the private public, I risk hurting people, telling what they do not wish widely known. I do it in the service of a dead thing, history. To my mother, this seems cruel precisely because I do it without malice. It is like shooting a bystander to test the gun. These people are dead. Let them lie. Let the evil be buried with them, or at least let it be talked of only among ourselves. It was one of those moments when the tensions within the book, the contest of history and memory, seemed so strong that the book itself must die. The second piece of cruelty involves forgetting. In my mother's stories, this is a problem attached to her husband and my father, Harry White. I ran into it when I tried to get her to expand on the story of how they met. At first, she found it hard to talk about how they regarded each other in those early days, and then weeks, and then months. These things, she told me, bring back too many memories, some good and some sad. To ask her to remember was to bring back more than memories of the war years. The Harry White she knew then, the Harry White she fell in love with, can never stand out as clearly as he did those first moments when he walked through a restaurant in the French Quarter of New Orleans towards her table. He is surrounded in memory now with the men he later became. The memory of him in the restaurant, if she does not concentrate on it intently, yields to other memories of a long and tumultuous marriage. The chronology that I, as a historian, want is not the way the past actually survives in my mother's mind. In memory, all the events of her romance with my father and their subsequent marriage mixed together like pennies that have been dropped for years into a jar. Reconstructing the order of their arrival, their chronology is hard. The chronology of her feelings is virtually impossible. But I want the impossible. I want her to remember the past as if she did not know everything that followed. I want her to put things back where they were that moment in 1942 when she did not yet know all that was going to happen. I want her to pretend with me that chronology, my history, is more real than the mixed and tangled remnants of her past that she now keeps in her memory. She initially refuses. She does not refuse flatly. She just does not tell me what I want to know. That's how my mother does things. So then I write what I know, what I've heard from others, including my father. And when she reads those first drafts, she reacts with indignation, anger, and hurt. She thinks that I treat him badly. She wants to protect his memory, her memory. She wants her silence to be final. Here more than any place else, she wants her memory to be uncontested. She does not want me talking to others, gathering other stories, looking into the remnants of my father's past. When she is silent, she wants those things about which she refuses to speak to remain as quiet as the tomb. That is the ultimate power of stories. They take on themselves the decision about what will be remembered and what will be told. The part of the past she claims most fiercely is the part she wants forgotten. But history, too, has its weaknesses. The great necessary fiction of history, I came to realize, was chronological time. I realized this on one level when I tried to get my mother to sort her memories chronologically, to pretend that she doesn't, that in fact, her memories of my father like the past itself doesn't exist in a great jumble in the present, but instead is neatly and chronologically preserved. But I realized it in another way when I tried to reconstruct the killing my mother claims to remember, although when it happened, she was only a few months old. My mother has told me vivid stories of the Irish Revolution. She tells me of the death of the IRA man, Eddie Carmody, at the Doctor's Cross in Ballylongford. She tells me of the time the Black and Tans invaded her mother's kitchen and beat her mother. But my mother was not a year old when Eddie Carmody died. She was a little more than one when the Black and Tans invaded her house. She cannot possibly remember these things. And yet, in another sense, my mother does remember. In a real sense, her oldest memories are 400 years old. They date from the time of Troubles. There are relics of the time of Troubles. And the time of Troubles in Ireland, as I found out, is everything that happened from about the 15th century down until the early 20th century. When I'd asked my aunt about why an old tower was in a field, the tower that dates from the Vikings, she'd say it's from the time of Troubles. When I'd ask them about a memorial during the Irish Revolution, she'd say, oh, that's from the time of Troubles. There are relics from the time of Troubles all around Ahanagran. The castle of the O'Connors that Cromwell's men blew a hole in is still the largest building in the region. There's an abbey at Lislawton, destroyed by the English 400 years ago, and is now a graveyard where my grandparents are buried. There's the memorial to Eddie Carmody, and another to the O'Reilly, born in Ballylongford, who died in the Easter Rising in Dublin. You ask about any of them, and the answer is always the same. That, they say, is from the Troubles. There is no history in this, as I, as a historian, understand history. To me, the destruction of the monastery, the two sieges of the castle, the death of Eddie Carmody, the hanging of the monks at Lislawton, are all separate and discrete events. Cromwell's men did not kill Eddie Carmody, any more than the Black and Tans hanged the monks at Lislawton Abbey 3.5 centuries before. But in the collective memory of Ballylongford, there is only one death. And that death is always at the hands of the English, be they Cromwell's men or the Black and Tans. It's the same death repeated over and over and over again. That death is the mark of the Troubles. To lay claim to any one event is to lay claim to all of them, because they are all the same. Brendan Kennelly, who's now the professor of modern literature at Trinity College, but who was born in Ballylongford, has written a long poem entitled Cromwell. When we were back at Trinity College, I was doing research there, and I came with my mother, who was actually helping me at one stage of the book, and she wanted to see Brendan Kennelly, who she doesn't know well. She left Ballylongford in 1936, and he's a little younger than she is. He was in a faculty meeting in the English department at Trinity College, where he holds the chair of modern literature. And she called up, she had the gateman call up and ask him to come down. I said, God, Mom, what? he's not gonna come down. And she said to the gateman, tell her that Sarah Welsh from Ballylongford is here. He came down. In Cromwell, he says, the poem is about, quote, the nightmare of Irish history. But his technique, he says, is imagistic and not chronological. The poem ignores chronological time and covers 400 years. The poem is all Cromwell. Kennelly has been true to the place where he was born. This is pretty much how Ballylongford sees it. But the memory of Ballylongford is, in another sense, itself impure. It has been trapped in history. The stories that my mother tells me, or not all the stories that my mother tells me, have survived on the strength of local memory. Some of them survived because we recovered them in other places. They survived because they were captured to serve a nationalizing project that was about the nation and history, and not locality and memory. Many of the stories told in Ballylongford in the 1930s were recorded. Leaders of the Irish Free State set about to construct a true Irish culture, distinct from the English culture, which they felt had contaminated the country. By the mid-1930s, rural people had become the designated keepers of national memory. They were the repository of true Irishness, and the Irish Folklore Commission gathered rural stories, particularly rural stories from the west of Ireland, where my mother comes from. And so school children, people the Welshes knew, their neighbors the Dees, their cousins the Hollies, wrote down these stories that they heard from parents and relatives and neighbors. And these stories, the common stock of the townland and village, now became the property of the Department of Irish Folklore at the University of Dublin, which now preserves them. The stories remain frozen, taken out of history, and deposited in the archives. This capturing of local memory for national history was a project that my mother, unbeknownst to herself, was entangled in from an early age. The easiest way to illustrate this is to tell a story. In 1981, I was in Ireland with my mother, my brother, and my son. And she took us to see the old national school, where she went up until the fourth grade, which was the end of her education. The school was now closed, and it had been vandalized. It was in ruins. And as we walked through it, we walked through with my cousin, Maggie, who still lives in Ballylongford, or did then. And I found an old ledger, which had been torn up and thrown on the floor. And I began picking up pages and glancing at it. Most of the ledger was in English, some of it was in Irish, but there were dates on it. And the dates were from 1925 and 1926. And I said, "Mom, weren't you in school here in 1925 and 1926? And she said, "Yeah, she was. But the names were all in Irish." So we went through it. I couldn't know what my mother's Irish name was. But Maggie teaches Irish in the schools. And she found what turned out to be my mother's attendance record from the second grade, lying there on the floor. It was under the name of Sora Bernach. Sora Bernach is my mother's name in Irish, but it's not a name that she's ever used except in school. I did not think then to ask my cousin Maggie what it meant. In some sense, I thought, well, that's her real name. I assumed that her name, Sarah Welsh, was an English translation. But what I found out was that the opposite was true. I asked my colleague, Robin Stacey, who reads Irish, what the name meant. Its literal translation was light or bright person from Britain. They had made Sarah her name into Swara, which had once been a common Irish name but no longer is. And that translates as light. They had chosen it simply because the two names sound alike. And then they had translated her last name, Welsh, into a person from Britain. So to emphasize her Irishness, my mother became a light British person. The name, like the Irish she learned, was an artifact of school. It had nothing to do with her daily life. And school, designed to make her Irish, was the most alien and alienating experience of her life in Ballylongford. She retained the Irish phrases embedded daily in English speech the way my other grandparents used Yiddish to pepper their speech. But school Irish made no impression on her. Once as a child, when I pestered her to say something in Irish, she gave me a phrase which I never, to her great embarrassment, forgot, and which was emblematic of the place from which she came. The phrase was, and I still have never forgotten it, Poga Mahon. It is not school Irish. It is the Irish retained in the daily life of the place. It captures the resistance to things like mandating Irish as an official language or imposing public memory. It means kiss my ass. As I thought about incidents like these, I kept getting forced deeper and deeper into this conundrum of memory and history, and forced to consider in very direct ways the nature of the history I teach. My history constantly subverted my mother's memories. Every story she told me that I could discover documentation about had happened, but none had happened as my mother remembered it. Memory, however, also subverted history. Sometimes it did so in obvious and predictable ways. Even though as a historian, I know that documents do not necessarily preserve the truth, but only what somebody reported at the time that the document was recorded, I was shocked when I read my grandfather's application for citizenship. He lied about what it was necessary to lie about, his illegal entry into the United States. This is strange to be giving this talk in Canada, which has always been something of a veil of tears for my family. My grandfather may have been the only immigrant in history who actually managed to get apprehended sneaking into the United States across the Canadian border in the 1920s. And so that he lied about that was not unusual. But he also lied or was mistaken about things that he could have answered accurately. He gave them his wrong birthday. He had the number of his children wrong. He never listed his youngest child at all. Such subversions of the documentary record are predictable. But what bothers me more are less the things that memory reveals to be false than what it reveals about the nature of historical claims and historical truths. Let me give two examples before closing. The first goes around the tendency of historians, particularly North American historians, to write national narratives. The second goes back to chronology. There is an argument that I partially accept that modern history has arisen with the nation state and that it serves the nation state. The attempts of Irish schools and teachers to create a national history, a national culture, and a national language from local folklore and memory during my mother's childhood was part of it. The organization of most North American college curriculums and historical specializations around national boundaries are another. History is organized to serve nations. Memory tends to be a family and locality. And when placed in conversation with history, memories can subvert national narratives. The stories my mother tells me constantly intersect with historical events. As a historian, I originally cast my mother's migration as a passage from Ireland to the United States, from one nation to another, from one way of life to another. And in part, this is how she casts it. It is a necessary part of the story. But I came to realize how such a construction, automatic to me as a historian, shuts off and distorts what her memory tells. Nations were not the only organization of space. National boundaries were not the only boundaries. As distant as Chicago was from County Kerry in the early 20th century, it was closer than Dublin was. My mother's father came from a family of 11 children. One died, and eight were in Chicago by the time he left Kerry in 1924. None of them, to the best of my knowledge, had ever seen Dublin. None could have found relatives in Dublin or gotten work there or gotten aid there. They could do all these things in Chicago. But Chicago was Chicago and not necessarily the United States. The same grandfather who came to Chicago and got American citizenship so he could bring his children there returned to Ireland in the 1950s. And when he did so, he lost his American citizenship. It appears that he never cared. My mother, I discovered, much to my surprise, did not become a citizen, and she'd kill me for saying this, even when I'm not in the United States, until she had been in the country for 25 years. Since she lived in Chicago, this, of course, was not a bar from her voting. Nation states were part of my mother's and grandfather's world, but nations did not fully define them. My mother's memories subvert my national narratives. But that's not all of it. I take chronology for granted. I still believe that there can be no history without it. But my mother's stories taught me more is involved in chronology than I realized. We lose as well as gain by it. There is one last story to tell, or rather a twinned pair. My mother, Sarah Welsh, was only 4 when her father left for America in 1924. It is one of her earliest memories. He left them to earn money to save his Irish farm. He could not pay the rents or the loan he had gotten to buy the farm during land redistribution. John Welsh left behind a wife, 5 children, and a nephew born out of wedlock whose mother, John Welsh's sister Kitty, was already in Chicago. His lone wife was pregnant with his last child. He had no idea how long he would be gone as he left his wife crying among her children on the road. As it turned out, he would be gone 23 years, with only one brief visit back. Before he returned for good, 3 of his children had joined him in the United States. This is an immigration story. The problem is that in history, it is severed from other stories it once stood among, stories once preserved in memory and passed on. It is severed, for example, from Richard McKessie's pony, which the fairies put up a tree. Sarah Welsh was only 3 or 4, more or less, the dates of such things are hardly exact, when the fairies took Richard McKessie's pony. Richard McKessie noticed his pony missing one evening. The whole family searched, but they found no sign of it. Richard McKessie went to bed thinking the pony would be back by morning, but it didn't come back, and so he resumed the search. That is when he found the pony hanging in a tree within a ferry fort on the farm. The pony was held fast between 2 branches. Let me leave the pony up the tree for a moment and think about the past where the pony remains lodged far more firmly than he was in that tree. The past is a set of connections that once ran only laterally or backwards. They could not run forward because the future had not yet happened. Both remembering the past and writing histories of the past forge connections between what happened then and what happened afterward and what exists now. The older connections, the connections of things that simply happen simultaneously in a single place, immigration and ponies up a tree, for example, become attenuated and lost. They are hard to restore. But memory here often serves us better than history. As a historian, I cannot say for certain when the ferry supposedly put Richard McKessie's horse up the tree. Indeed, as a historian, I can say with some assurance that the fairies never put Richard McKessie's pony up the tree. And yet, after listening to my mother's stories, I think it is necessary, if I want to understand Jack Welsh and his daughter Sarah, to put Richard McKessie's pony back up that tree. That pony is as necessary as the rates and the revolution and Chicago to understand my grandfather's immigration and the place he came from, and my mother's immigration and the place she came from. My own need to chronologize, to make a tunnel through time into which some events and not others can pass, and only in a certain order, too easily blinds me the connections between events that simply occurred in the same place. My mother's memories remind me of that. But my mother's stories and memories alter my history even more than this. They humble me a little. If popular culture confuses memory with history, historians tend to conflate history with the past. Historians routinely complain that most people have no sense of the past, no sense of history. But this is not true. I am the only historian in my family. But I live in a family full of stories about the past, resentments about the past, endless recastings of the past, and conscious erasures of the past. When my mother explains herself, she tells stories about her past. Only by conflating the past with history can I say that she and my other relatives have no interest in the past. Memory and history are different and often rival constructions of the past. And while I have chosen, and I still choose history, I have come away with a new respect for memory and a renewed sense of what a daunting, difficult, and complicated thing it is to tell stories at all true to the past. My mother's memories and stories have taught me that this is far more difficult than I ever imagined. I had thought that in writing a history of memories, I could domesticate memory and put it at the service of history. And in part, I think I have. But like my mother, her memories are too resilient and too independent to be confined. They still come back to subvert my histories. And I think I'm more than willing to settle for that. Thank you. Well, I usually emphasize significance of what do I emphasize to my own undergraduate students about the significance of history as I teach it? I emphasize two things. First of all, I emphasize that there's not a history, there are histories, and that these are contested. And the second thing I try to emphasize to them, because I'm largely teaching still 18 to 20-year-olds, who come into my classroom thinking, in fact, that the future is totally in their hands, that the world is ready to be made over again now that they're here, that history might have some relevance to the past, but it certainly is very relevant to them. What I do is I give them an assignment where they have to take their own family and put it into the trends of modern history, some event, some trend that's going on. What I try to convince them, I know there's no sense that I'm going to convince an 18-year-old that, in fact, the world is not going to be exactly as he or she wants it to be. But sometimes I convince them that their parents did not have a full range of choices in the world, that what was going on in the world had shaped their parents' lives or their grandparents' lives, and the factors that shaped them did not begin necessarily yesterday, but have been at work for a long time. What I try to do is give them some sense that, in fact, while we act in a world and we have agency and we have choices, those choices are shaped by history. They're a limited set of choices. They are not necessarily a set of choices in which everything you can imagine you can achieve. And if I do that, I'm more than happy. Clearly what's happening here, this would go to what I was saying about the past, is that the construction of the past is history, which I very much believe in, is largely a work of academically trained historians. There are other ways of constructing the past. My mother's memory is a good example. So too are ways that Native peoples in both the United States and in Canada construct the past. Those are not histories. But at the same time, what they do is that they have a way of trying to find truth in the past which goes towards the truth. That truth is not necessarily the same thing that I, as an academic historian, am always going to accept. I think I would be prepared to be as humbled, and not to agree, but certainly to realize I'm in a fight here, to be as humbled by other ways of restoring that past. And particularly when, if you leave out those kinds of stories, you give a monolithic power to one group to define the past, then it's best to widen the horizons of the past. These become incredibly tangled instances. Does that mean that I believe that every record of public memory, every memory is simply true? Of course not. That's what I've been talking about. But I am willing to grant them a degree of truth. Getting at that truth is the trick. That's the difficult task. Okay, the question goes to the Kennedy tapes that have recently come up about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the question is whether I, as a historian, would say that such taping of conversations should be encouraged as a check for historical accuracy. Is that true? No. And the basic reason is those can be a very easily manipulated historical source. Just as when my grandfather recorded a document, which I can recover just as he had it recorded in 1924, and every single thing on it is false. It is just as possible, if you know that things are being taped and can be used to verify it, to falsify tapes. These kinds of, there is no perfect historical source. All I can say about historical sources as regard to memory, and the key distinction to them is an important one, is that a historical source, once it's recorded, unless it has been tampered with and altered, does not change, though interpretations and other things change. Memory, as we all know, when we tell stories about our past, I don't have to tell you this, you know it deep in your hearts, you change the past. You change the past to make sense of the present, that in fact the past itself is changing. The memory is much more malleable than the kinds of sources that historians work with. They are two different ways of gaining access to the past. And that both of them lead to different places in the past. History to a much more confined place. Well, the question is, as a historian, how do I feel about rewriting history to be true to our beliefs today or correspond with our beliefs today? Well, I mean, that's clearly a loaded question. I clearly don't believe that you rewrite history to correspond to our beliefs today. But does that mean that we necessarily accept history as written in the early 20th century? No, because in fact, all histories are in part a product of the time in which they were recorded. The major thing that changes in history is that the historians today ask a very different set of questions than were asked in the early 20th century. And I think for non-historians, as they see it, well, you write a history, the past is gone, what's there to change? Well, there's an awful lot to change. Because, in fact, there is no history, as I said, to find. There's only a history to create. And the history you create based on sources depends on the questions you ask. And the questions you ask depends on the society that you live on. So there's no history that is going to be permanent. The questions that concern me as a historian today are not going to be the questions that concern people 50 years from now. And in part, what I write about can seem bewildering to them. Why in the world did I care about these things? Which isn't to say that I've gotten my facts wrong or anything else, though it might turn out that, in fact, there's a whole body of literature that I never thought to look at, which could have changed my own opinion. Well, the question is, they say the history of conflict is always written by the winners, and can I find an example of such a discrepancy? By discrepancy, you mean history written by the losers? Well, you know, let's put it this way. My family background is I'm Irish and I'm Jewish. Haven't been a lot of victories. And I think that's precisely why I'm fascinated with history, to tell you the truth. The question is what about my father's side of the story? There's a large amount of my father's side of the story. Here I'm emphasizing my mother's side, and the major reason is that this is about memory and history. My father's memories, my father died 25 years ago, so this was not a work in which I could question my father's memories now. What I do work with is the stories my father told me, and then also going back and talking to my uncles and my aunts. There's one set of stories, and I'll tell this very briefly because it's a long story, but it's a good example of my father's side. My grandfather was a... This is another time where Canada got us in a lot of trouble. My grandfather was a Russian Jewish immigrant, came from what is now the Ukraine. He came in when he was 11 years old into New York. And he, like everybody else in my family, was rather lax in getting his citizenship, as it turns out. He did not become a citizen, though he took out his first papers. He practiced law. Again, he was in Boston and involved with the Curling Machine, so it did not mean that he was not politically active. He was very politically active. And then in my father's story, which I'll relate very briefly, he said that my grandfather was caught in a street paving contract deal with the Curling Machine, which was going on all the time. And it was case of taking kickbacks, and the trial was my grandfather, who's Jewish, two aldermen who were Irish, and the judge was Irish. They had him cold. Somebody had to take the fall. It was my grandfather. That's my father's story, and I believe that. I believe that all the way through childhood. One of the things I did was I got the trial records eventually. My uncle, who had, when I'd asked him about the trial, it was very clear he didn't want to talk about this or my grandfather going to prison. So I had no desire to cause problems with my uncle, so I dropped the subject, but I went to search and see what I could find out. I found the transcript of my grandfather's trial. And what I found was, as I'll say in a minute, was that the story was very different from what my father had told me. I told my brother this, and he said, well, does, and I won't name my uncle because he doesn't like to be associated with this story, but does he know about it? And I said, no, Stephen, I don't think he wants to know about it. So Stephen said, can I ask? I said, sure. So he called and said, you know what Richard found? There's a long pause, and my uncle said, how did he find that? And Stephen said, he's a historian. That's his job. He's supposed to find things. But he didn't want to see it. So I read the trial record, and the trial record turned out to be very interesting. All the defendants were Jewish. There was no Irish involved in the trial except lawyers who were character witnesses for my grandfather. The trial had nothing to do with the street paving contract. It had to do with the sale of a truck. My grandfather did, and I can't tell if he was guilty or innocent from the trial, to tell you the truth. He did go to Atlanta Penitentiary. And the person who sent him there, the prosecuting attorney's name was John Welsh, which is my mother's father's name, though this is, he's not the same person, so that's an odd coincidence. But what came out of it later was that what followed then is that after he was sent to prison, it ruined him in many ways. He was interviewed by the U.S. Immigration Service, and my grandfather, I idolized him, and I can't imagine what was on his mind when he did this, because you have federal immigration agents showing up at Atlanta Penitentiary and start asking you questions. You tell them nothing. You don't tell them anything. And they asked him, well, have you gone on vacation? He said, yeah, I've gone on vacations. He said, well, have you ever gone on vacation to Canada? And he said, yeah, well, and he remembered a trip they took to Niagara Falls, and they crossed over the border, and he might have spent a night in Canada, or they might have come back that afternoon. He didn't know. But under U.S. immigration law at the time, any immigrant who was convicted of a felony within 10 years of immigration would be deported back where they came from. My grandfather should have been safe. He came in when he was 11 years old. But what's the date of immigration? Date of immigration is the last time you left the country. So my grandfather's vacation in Canada became an order for deportation. The way I found the whole thing is the only part of my father's story that was true to the last detail, well, even that's not true to the last detail. The way I found the records was that he used to say, and your grandfather was the only Democrat ever pardoned by Herbert Hoover. He wasn't the only Democrat ever pardoned by Herbert Hoover, but he was pardoned by Herbert Hoover, and that's how I found the records. But what I realized when I began to understand this, why would my father change the story? Why would he change it this way? And the only sense I could make is because both families opposed the marriage, that what my father was telling me, in a way, was a story about Romeo and Juliet. That, in fact, what it was this long animosity between Irish and Jews, how the Irish had persecuted the Jews, which he needed my grandfather's story here for, and how, despite that, he and my mother had crossed these lines, despite the grave objections both of them should have had and that the family still opposed it. But it's one of these ways in which a family story just gets altered out of a real event to make sense of something else. So that's the story that was communicated to me. So half the book, the latter half of the book, particularly after this, is in fact as much devoted to my father's family as my mother's family, because when they were married, they both sides severed contact with them, but the contact was reestablished with the Jewish side of my family much more than the Irish side. And when I was growing up, all the relatives I saw until I was a teenager were Jewish, not Irish. So that's a long answer. Not another family history, I'll tell you that. I'm going to go back to the Western United States, and I'm going to do a very big book, which will be around the impact of railroads, and not just writing another history of railroads, but the argument is that if you look at how railroads in the United States, Canada, and northern Mexico came in, they and the corporate capital they represented were the forces that, in fact, established racial relations, settlement patterns, environmental change, that around them is an explanation for not just the American West, but a whole, indeed the whole Western part of the continent. The farthest away I can get from anybody I'm related to at this point, the better off I am.
I first came into contact with Richard White's ideas about 5 or 6 years ago, I guess. I was teaching a graduate seminar here at UBC on culture contact in the Americas, and I assigned one of his books, which one of the ones that you saw on the table out here as you come in, one with a red cover, The Middle Ground. And the conversation between myself and the students went something like this. You've assigned White's book, have you, sir? Uh-huh. Do you know how big it is? I do. Do we have to read the whole book? Uh-huh. That's about 525 pages, isn't it? That's a lot. Uh-huh. It's worth reading. Have you looked, sir, at the size of the print in the book? It's about 8 points. That's the size where, when you get to my age, you need arm extenders to read it out here. And if you're young, you can read it up this close. I went on to say, yes, I knew the size of the print, and it was still worth reading. Did you know, sir, you can't read that on the bus? I said something like, well, you know, life is unfair, or take it home and read it at home, or whatever. A week later, I came back into the seminar room, and sure enough, I looked around the room, and the eyes of 4 or 5 of my students were kind of going like this. They tried to read it on the bus. But what they all said was, wow, this really was worth reading. And I said, all 525 pages? And they said, well, he might have cut it down to 450. But the point I wanted to make is simply that if those students, and maybe there's some of them here tonight, I don't know, but if those students were here tonight, they would say that, wow, again tonight. And they would say, give us more, not less. And I think that in many ways, Professor White, you're right. This issue of memory and history is an old one in some ways, but I think you've given it a great deal of freshness here tonight by personalizing in the way you have and by sharing something of your own past in relating some of the issues that deal with that tension between memory and history. Please join with me in thanking Professor White.